Welcome to Insights as a Service. This is the podcast that is designed to help MSPs get ahead. And today we're going to do that by getting to know Agile. What is it? It's a very important question. Is it right for your business? And if so, why? And to do that, we're going to be talking to Tim Phillips from Unfuddle. Tim and I have worked together in various roles in different companies for about 10 years now, and he is an absolute subject matter expert when it comes to Agile. So that said, let's get stuck in. All right, Tim Phillips, let's start with letting you do a bit of your own introduction. Why don't you give us the quick version of your sort of history, and particularly because we're here today to talk about Agile in relation to MSPs, how they might be able to utilize it, whether it makes sense for them, whether it's something they should be interested in. Talk to us about your experience in that space as well.
Thank you. Yeah. So, as you know, but some of the listeners won't, I've been involved in the service provider industry since the late 90s, worked in various ISPs, Slingshot, Paradise, iForFree, which was one of the first large dial-up providers in New Zealand. And as you know, working with you in two sort of instances, but early 2000, some friends and I got together and we decided to start up a web hosting business called iServe, which we sort of grew in early 2000, sort of got it up to about 30,000 customers, and then we sold that off to Orcon. After that, I set up a small consulting firm with my wife, and as you know, two sort of engagements with you in the ISP space, but I've done a bit of work for a company called Namecheap.com. They're one of the largest ICANN accredited domain registrars, and really enjoyed the opportunity to come and work with you at Livewire and sort of bring agile ways of working and really reorganize the way that we sort of looked at projects or pieces of work. At the moment, I've been working for the last 3 years with Voyager, basically doing the same thing.
Yeah. So when you came in and worked with us at Livewire, we were at a stage where we had a lot of development projects. We had a lot of competing priorities, potentially. We couldn't do everything at once. And when we had projects, we weren't really sure how well they were tracking, which people were best to focus on which parts of it. You came in and you gave us guidance on how to set up structures and sort of methodologies that would help us really track how we were going against the stated aims for a sprint or for a quarter, and actually implementing sprints as a concept. There's a whole bunch of things that you did that are still with us today and have helped us hugely. And I wanted to talk to you because I think that for the MSPs that are listening, there might be a number that have, depending on their size, similar problems. But also just generally, there's so much talk about Agile. Spark was a big one in New Zealand who made a lot of press talking about their move to Agile and what it meant for their customers and their business. But often it can feel, I think, for those who aren't particularly aware of exactly what Agile is, it can feel like a lot of buzz. And to be honest, at times I've felt the same way. So I guess maybe we can start off the conversation just with your take on what Agile is, and whether it's actually a methodology or whether it's more of a set of principles, potentially.
Yep, sure. In early 2000, a whole bunch of people got together to sort of draft up this thing called the Agile Manifesto. But I think if you sort of distill down what it is, it's about empowering people and having the right people, giving them the opportunity to to do basically the best work that they possibly can. A lot of it's focused around customer experience. We're hearing a lot of that these days around, nice intuitive UIs, that whole customer experience end to end. So that's baked in there. There's the sort of growth mindset components, which are around sort of changing requirements, that while we can plan out our work, something like COVID might jump in the way and say, radically, by the way, you guys have to work from home for now. Everything that we'd planned out for the last sort of, two quarters is out the window. We've got to do things differently. So the Agile Manifesto sort of requires that you're sort of more open to the opportunity that things might change, business requirements might change. We're not talking about things changing on a day-to-day basis, but, what we think we might need in the next quarter, two quarters, we might get there and it's not what we need today. So there's that concept. There's also this sort of deliver working software and sort of minimize a lot of the the manual components. So removing all of the sort of toil, you know, with sort of building, deploying, managing. And it's really around, you know, that frequency or that sort of cadence that you're actually working to. So, you know, a lot of the companies that I work with that sort of, you know, adopt Agile, they're using Scrum as well, because it gives them the ability to sort of set up these sprints, as you know, that we did with Lightwire. And basically knowing that sort of every 2 weeks, you've got something continuously coming off the pipeline. And 2 weeks is really not a long time between, you know, coming up with a requirement and actually seeing it pop out the other end. So there's that. One of the other components that I keep hearing in the industry that, you know, people say, you know, we don't really want to go to Agile because it's going to mean that the quality of what we're doing is actually, you know, not as high, because, you know, we're not going through all this planning and sort of iteration. I actually find it's quite often the opposite. You know, maybe the quality isn't good as people are sort of starting to onboard and learn, but as we sort of, you know, sort of mature as a team, you're finding that they're thinking deeper about the work that they're doing and you know, what they're delivering. And one of the other key components around this is basically connecting everyone in the team. So you're sort of removing the old fashioned sort of gatekeepers. You don't need to go to ask your manager for approval to talk to somebody else. You know, these people are sitting alongside you. You know, part of it is the business people and developers collaborating. So it's really about, you know, just sort of all of those things and also getting to a sustainable pace that we can figure out what the cadence, how much work we able to do in the next 2 weeks, how much can we do in the next quarter, you know, roughly what could we do, you know, over the next half a year or a full year.
Okay. So I guess what you've told me there is it is a set of guiding principles, but there's also a lot of words you chucked in there, you know, the Scrum, you know, for example, the first one that goes out there, and, you know, there's always the tribe, there's Kanban, there's a few other things, sprints, obviously. So can we maybe go through some of those words? Like, if we start with Scrum, since you threw it out there, what does that actually mean?
Yeah, so Scrum was sort of adopted as a way that teams could sort of break down, visualize their work and sort of iterate over that. Initially, it was really sort of used for software-based delivery. But what we're finding now is that you've got these fully cross-functional teams where they're sort of pollinated with different skill sets. You know, you might have a team that's comprised of, you know, a developer, a sort of QA engineer, you know, it might have systems engineers, network engineers. All of these people are working together towards some sort of common goal, normally sort of wrapped around a product or some sort of business initiative. So what we're seeing there is that, you know, Scrum gives you this sort of guardrails that, you know, that we know that we're planning for roughly 2 weeks of the work. You know, here's how we define if the work's ready to come into the team. There might be some requirements that that need to be met, you know, sort of architectural constraints, you know, business validation, all of those things. So, and as part of what the teams are doing as well these days, a lot of the more mature teams, they're sort of defining a really good way to indicate when the work is done. So, you know, does done mean that we've, you know, sort of deployed it into a sort of particular environment, or does done mean that it's ready for sort of UAT testing internally or what have you? So yeah, there's all of those things, you know, that sort of comprise the Scrum framework. And as teams get larger, quite often, you know, they're sort of looking at multiple Scrum teams within the business. And this is where the sort of the concept of tribes can come in, is where you're looking at connecting more components within the business to the work that the teams are doing. So a good example with Voyager, you know, in 2019, we'd set up these Scrum teams. In 2020, we sort of adapted those to be more tribe focused. So what we were doing there is they weren't just purely the software developers and the network engineers and the systems engineers. We're actually bringing subject matter expertise from around the business. So from marketing, from operations, from finance, so that we can actually sequence everything. We've got a lot of end-to-end connectivity, breaking down sort of silos. You don't need to go and, you know, sort of schedule meetings with people to be able to ask questions as you're sort of pushing, you know, product and initiatives forward.
So a couple of questions there for you. One, I'll come back to the question around tribes in a sec, but and this isn't so much of a question as a point, but that concept of done is huge, because even at Lightwire, that's something we've struggled with, you know, the concept of done to a developer versus the concept of done to a customer versus, you know, the stakeholder, if that's a BDM or someone in the marketing team, whoever's requested the product, they're so different. And that's where, you know, we'd say, where's that at? And the developer will say, oh, it's done. Like, well, that's weird because I haven't seen any UAT. Or someone will say, yeah, it's UAT. It's good to go. And you're like, well, have we actually educated anyone about how to use it yet? Because that's a big part of it too, right? It's great to have a product out, but if it's internal facing and you're like, yeah, it's live. Who have we told? Who have we trained? Like, is that done? And that's what we've really, really struggled with. And so that's a great point. But the other thing around tribes, just to try and get my head around it too, because again, I've not worked in an environment where that's the norm. Is it that someone would have a title like me where that's their day job, but they're also part of a tribe for a particular project for the duration of that project? And there's an element of their work day, their work week, work month that's dedicated to working within that tribe. Is that the concept?
Yeah. So, it's a really good question. So normally the good components that sort of build up a tribe is obviously all of those people that are working in that Scrum team. So, you know, your developers and systems, networks, engineers, Scrum Masters, product owner. I like to think of the people that are needed as sort of subject matter experts. So it might be somebody that really understands the operational nature so that when you're readying some changes, they can actually ensure that your help desk or your customer service team have got all the supporting documentation, they're trained and so forth. So with the tribes, I coming back to that sort of subject matter expertise, it's whoever you need to actually fulfill that. So there might be a marketing component, as you say. You know, we might need to stand up some video content that we're actually sort of pushing or priming before we actually deploy the features. Also coming back to that sort of definition of done, I think that the teams that I see maturing over time, they're actually constantly reflecting because they've sort of got that growth mindset. They want to improve continually, you know, sort of compounding each iteration that they go through. So quite often what they're doing is looking at what does done mean to me? What does it mean to the team? And really kind of writing that stuff down so that before we actually embark on the work, everyone has a shared understanding of what done means. So I know that was something that we, you know, managed to get in at Lightwire, and it was something that, you know, it continually needs to be improved. And, you know, as you learn, you validate, you bring all of those learnings back into the team, and you just sort of mature continuously.
And I guess if you're working to a sprint with it's like a two-weekly sprint, your definition of done for each sprint is very, very different than an overall project, right? So like your definition of done is situationally dependent or situation dependent.
Absolutely.
So that's kind of a bit of a brain scratcher as well, a head scratcher. But the sprint cadence, I guess, what have you seen work well and what have you seen not work well in terms of the time that you allocate for a sprint?
Yeah, so initially when I did a bit of work with Namecheap.com in India, sort of helping reorganize some of their individual teams into product-focused teams, we went for a one-week cadence. And what we found is that the planning requirements and overhead was very, very low. The problem with that is 5 days isn't very long. So what I find most of the time is 2 weeks seems to be a roughly, you know, good balance, that it's not too much planning, but it's not, you know, too little planning as well. As we sort of see mature more into a larger enterprise environment, some of those are actually going for sort of 4 week or even 6 week sprint cycles as well. So obviously with those, it depends purely on, you know, what works for the team, what works for the business. And again, just sort of using that continual improvement mindset is just figuring out, do we move from 1 to 2 weeks? Do we go, you know, two? Do we experiment with a four-week sprint? It's all around the amount of preparation and sort of balance. But I try and let the teams figure out what works best for them, because if we're empowering them to, you know, do their best work, if they say that they want to do it in 4 weeks, doesn't mean that you have to hold off for 4 weeks before you release these changes. You can do that incrementally through the sprint cycle. But it's just whatever works best for the team and the situation.
So I guess a big part of that then is that before any of this kicks off, that the stakeholders, both from a business perspective and a project perspective, need to be involved to go, what do we need to achieve and by when? And therefore, what resources are required to achieve that? How do we break that work down? And what is the definition of done for each stage before we can move on to the next stage? Is that, or is that getting away from that sort of agile methodology because that's too restrictive?
I don't think so. I think, again, just sort of bring it back to the team, figure out what's working. Like if you're seeing an uptick in the amount, sort of the throughput, and it's not compromising on quality and the team's happy and you've got that sustainable pace, and that's fine. What we found at Lightwire, once we started getting more visibility at the high level, when we had those high level roadmaps, is that we could actually see the interdependencies that were going to be causing resourcing issues as we were sort of scaling across the teams in particular work. So it gives you visibility and the ability to sort of strategize more and reorganize that work. And once we started to see that, we were able to, I think Andrew mentioned that, within the first quarter of doing that, we were almost kicking all of the goals that we'd set for that quarter. And again, that sort of feeds into that planning cycle. So again, that might work well for Lightwire, but it might not work well for somebody else. And I think just sort of going with that, just sort of incremental improvement mindset, that just sort of experiment with it. If it works, it works. What parts do work? What do we need to do more of? And what do we need to sort of reframe?
It's a great call, because I remember that was one of the greatest insights we got, is that we had these various developers that we've got, like maybe 8 full-time devs now. It was probably not quite that back when you were with us, but we found that when you gave us the ability to look at the when you helped us size projects, when you helped us understand who needed to do what within each project, we saw that so many of those projects had a dependency on a single person, or maybe two people, and they can only do so much in a day. So we hadn't really identified that was what was holding us back so often from some getting a greater cadence to the projects that we were both running with concurrently and also delivering on. And that definitely helped from a understanding what we needed to recruit, the skills that we were missing. Definitely helped drive us forward. So, okay, we've gone through Scrum. We've sort of talked about sprints. When we talk about Kanban, is that an alternative to Scrum? Is it the same thing or a portion of? What is that?
So a lot of the teams use some sort of board to visualize their work. It could be a whiteboard or, on a glass window somewhere with a whole lot of post-its, the work that you want to do, what you're working on now, and what's considered done. So I think, in the sprint cycle, as I mentioned, Kanban is a large component of that. It's so simple to get your head around. It takes sort of 5 or 10 minutes to sort of explain that. For some of the teams that I've worked with, Scrum and the amount of planning is a little bit of overhead for what they need to do. So moving into that sort of Kanban, that sort of iterative style is easy for them. I quite often find, operational teams, where they might have sort of business as usual activities, Kanban's a good way for them to be able to visualize the amount of work that they've got, so that you can, again, sort of address that resourcing issue. Are we expecting too much of the team? One other good component about Kanban is the ability to sort of visualize and limit the amount of work in progress. And again, that's what you mentioned before about that high level strategy, is we didn't have the visibility that we needed to be able to actually see what we were working on, what sequenced needed to be sequenced, and again, sort of those interdependencies that we had. And sometimes it comes down to, do we need to do more cross training within the teams because we're highly dependent on this one person? What's the bus factor on that? So there's a whole lot that you can sort of learn from that. But again, is Scrum the right thing? Is Kanban the right thing? I think just encourage people just to experiment with it. Just go for the next 2 weeks, try this. If it works, let's do more of that. If it doesn't work, let's change.
Yeah, and I think maybe that's one of your legacies in our business too, is you actually got us using Atlassian's suite of products in a very different way. We had Jira, but we weren't really getting the most out of it. And you helped us configure burn down charts and size, sort our sizing, as I said earlier. Over time, though, to your point about, again, being agile, thinking about what works for you, what the rest of the business is doing, whether or not we're communicating well with the rest of the business from a development standpoint, over time, we're finding we're more and more moving to monday.com, which is just slightly simplified, easier to have a single pane of glass for communication throughout the business. Because again, if you've got those tribes, which we don't necessarily call it, but for all intents and purposes, that's what we're doing. You've got people from all parts of the business who aren't necessarily able to really understand a fairly complex platform like Jira. Pardon me. So that's working well for us. And it also helps, I think, that monday.com is getting more powerful as it matures, which is quite useful as well for people in our business like Scott and others who actually know how to make the most of it. And I do not. But that's cool. I think what I want to do too later on is I'll go through the Agile Manifesto you mentioned earlier, and we'll just sort of step through the key parts of that, and I got a couple of questions around them.
MSPs need a telco partner that complements their services, not competes. I came up with that phrase, so hopefully you like it. In either case, it's true, and that partner focus is one of the key things that sets Lightwire apart in this ever-changing ICT landscape. Check us out at lightwirebusiness.com.
But I guess in terms of success stories, can you maybe give us one of the ones that stands out to you as a business that's kind of transformed through adapting agile practices, but also maybe one that's really not quite understood it, tried it, not really embraced it because it went against company culture? And feel free not to mention names on that last one if it's too close to home, but it could be more of one you just heard about third hand.
Yeah. Look, I think every business that I've been involved with that has tried adopting agile ways of working and, you know, that's been open to Kanban and Scrum, I think they've ultimately transformed to be better than they were previously. So I don't think there's any sort of detractors. I think the biggest part is lost opportunity. Companies that probably could have, you know, really maximized on that by taking that and just challenging the teams to think differently, to hold them to a higher account, and particularly around cost of delay, you know, sort of not delaying stuff to the point that it becomes a problem and it's really slowing down what you're doing. But I think for me, and if we look at the financial side of it, is and this is at the really the high level, is Namecheap.com. So when I went in, and I think it was 2016, they were around 400 or 500 people. They were doing sort of blitz scaling. So I think just before I left in 2017, they were around 1,100 people. We needed to really radically change the way that we were working because we had people sort of tripping over each other. They were trying to work on the same code base. There was no synchronization. So there was a radical movement to move to what they call the scaled agile framework. So it's basically using agile at a higher level where you've got teams of teams and what they found there is they started sort of breaking all those interdependencies down into, you know, what people call microservices these days, basically what's allowed the companies like AWS Amazon and Netflix to do so well is they compartmentalized the smallest units that they possibly could and then wrapped a very small team around that. And I think when I looked, I think it was like 2017, Namecheap was about 90 million US. And then I think a year later, it was like 140. And a year after that, it was like, 150, 160. And then so within three or four years, they basically doubled their revenue. So I think you've got to be quite ruthless about the way that you do that. You've got to, you know, say no to a whole lot of things. You've got to reorganize people. You've got to get the right people on the bus, make sure that they're thinking the right way. So I think it's probably not just one change. It's probably not just agile that's worked for them. It's a whole, you know, it's everything that compounds moving forward. But yeah, that's the one that stands out for me from that high level. And I think the quickest transformation that I've ever done is working with you guys at Lightwire. I think the mindsets and the people were just there. They knew what they wanted to do. They knew what they were capable of doing. You know, Andrew and you and Scott, you know, from the leadership level, empower people probably, you know, far more than I see in any other businesses at the moment. Just the level of autonomy you give. So
yeah, it's all
you really, yeah, you removed all the detractors. And basically we, you know, every time we would suggest something, people were like, yeah, let's give that a go. So it's just that whole mindset and, you know, freedom.
Which I guess comes back to your point about getting the right people on the bus. We've got a great attitude within the team that does come from the top. Yeah, I mean, you're not going to get buy-in unless you've got the right attitude from the right people. So it's also funny. Sometimes you don't realize, I feel really bad now that I said it's all me. I'm joking, obviously, very, very, very much joking. Sorry, Scott. Sorry, Andrew. The funny thing for me is that often you're working in a way that aligns with the principles of agile. For example, you know, we really embrace the whole testing concept, bullets and cannonballs. I always talk about it, but it obviously aligns with that. You try, if it doesn't work, you iterate, you keep improving. The other one is retrospectives, whether it worked well or didn't work well. What can we learn? What can we do better? What should we realize now works well and use that in other projects that we're running? And that particular one probably didn't exist before you came in and is very much a legacy of that, but it's been great for the business. I guess because we're here on this podcast really to help MSPs that are looking to grow their business and do more, what would you say an MSP could solve or do better through Agile? It's probably a very open question that it could be almost anything. But if you were to work with an MSP, and perhaps you have, but you know, what sort of problems could they address through moving to a more Agile way of working?
Yeah, I think you've sort of addressed a little bit of that just, you know, in your last comments around it's a lot of it. We were doing this sort of stuff anyway, or we had the mindsets and we were looking at continually improving what we're doing, not repeating the same steps and expecting a different outcome. So, recently I caught up with the CIO at SOMAR Digital in Wellington. So they're a digital agency. They've got a lot of enterprise and government clients. So obviously the way that they work is in Agile sprints. They actually have part of their business is actually coaching and bringing their clients in and doing Agile workshops and getting them to think differently. So they are really looking at bringing people along on this sort of journey, as they call it, and getting the right mindsets, making sure that they can sort of encourage people that everyone's aligned in the way that we work, the way that we think, and being able to sort of break work down, figure out, you know, where is the most value, being highly connected to your customers. So I think that SOMAR Digital example could, you know, relate directly to the MSP space. They're really, really getting stuck in with the clients. It makes probably the relationship a lot more sticky as well. They're not just working on projects for their clients. They're actually looking at solving value problems and looking at outcomes. And I think there's an opportunity there. And I think I shared yesterday with you that a company called Rackspace.com, so they've got this concept called Elastic Engineering, which I think they released last year. And basically, this is the ability for you to bring, just like you can spin up on Amazon, you can spin up you know, cloud instances for an hour a day, you know, a month. So they have this concept around people as well. So you can spin up the capabilities that you actually need, have them running horizontally alongside your business. And again, you know, if you're doing sprints, they're in the same cadence as your team. There's no gatekeepers. There's no sort of creating a Jira ticket for somebody to actually go and, you know, provision some infrastructure. You're connecting and collaborating at that high level. So for me, I think there's a massive opportunity for MSPs to sort of at least explore that as an option. There could be a way to, you know, just be way more involved in your customer's business and really understanding and identifying, you know, potential opportunities that might help accelerate what your clients need to do. So rather than just being sort of, you know, bricks and mortar, you know, provisioning, you know, servers and managing and maintaining.
And yeah, you've touched on something interesting there, because for a lot of MSPs, there's obviously that professional services element too. There's one-off projects that come into it. And we've talked a lot so far today about the internal application of Agile, but the external application, the ability to be very transparent with customers, to have regular and sort of very detailed contact, to give them a single pane of glass throughout the project, to have them as stakeholders throughout, I guess that all feeds back. So it's really a way of getting greater buy-in, more touch points, etc., with your actual users, your customers.
Yeah, I mean, I think because I think just as I was finishing up with Lightwire, you'd started this sort of roadshow where you would go around, talk to your clients, figure out, are we building the right things? Are they adding value? Are you using them? So this is the advisory board there.
Yeah,
exactly. That's just connecting with your people and making sure that you're solving the right problems, because what you and I might think is a problem that we need to solve is totally different one than what the user does. And if we think to the startup that we tried Momi just before, you know, sort of COVID, that was totally radical. You know, we thought we were solving a particular problem, but once we actually started building it, we started, you know, seeing that the users were sort of expecting a slightly different sort of model for that, and, you know, sort of pivoting. And if you ignore those indicators, you know, you'll end up sort of minimizing the amount of value that you can actually derive over time.
Mm. Yeah. Even thinking about our advisory board process, which for anyone listening is essentially where once a quarter we at Lightwire, we talk to usually 10 or so customers a quarter, and we say, look, these are our priorities for next quarter. Do they align with what you think is important? Here's what we achieved last quarter in terms of developments, feature releases, etc. Do they actually tick the boxes for you, or are you expecting something different, or do they need to be iterated on? So it's funny, we didn't do that because we thought we're an agile company, we need to do something agile. It's just it kind of really cements for me the point that agile isn't a methodology. It's a way of working, and within that sort of scope, there's many ways to achieve well, damn near anything, but by just having a mindset that's aligned with those 12 core principles. So
agreed. Yeah,
that's cool. Okay. So recruitment was something I thought about as well, where two things. Is there an alternative to Agile? Like, what are the competing concepts out there? If you're not working with Agile, what are you doing?
That's a really good question. It's never really failed me, so I've never really needed to sort of go and fix that problem. But again, I think it's that open mindset that if you get to a point and it's limiting what you're doing and you feel that there's, you know, an opportunity that you're missing, go exploring, figure out. Spotify, they brought out that sort of squads and tribes model. So, they were sort of working, I think they had scrum masters at the time, sort of helping in that servant leadership role in the team. They realized that they needed a slightly different capability in there. So they've sort of moved away from that, and they've got sort of agile coaches. And I think there's even a concept of these agile team facilitators now as well. So I think, there's evolution there, and I think people are sort of solving particular problems a particular way. That's why whenever I go and work in a particular contract or with a new client, is they never use Agile and Scrum the exact same way. The way that Voyager do it now is very different to the way that Lightwire do it, and likewise with, Namecheap. So I think you've just got to get your flavor on it, figure out what works, and it's just keep asking questions and keep trying experiments to see if you get a better outcome.
And when you're employing systems engineers, network engineers, developers, smart people, basically, do you think it's a recruitment advantage to have a proven track record of working, as an agile company?
That is a really good question. Done a lot of recruiting over the last year, and it's been very difficult because of COVID, closed borders. We just don't have the available talent that we would normally have. And I think when I ask people, how did they work? What was their working style? I never really get the same answers twice. And that sort of tells me that, people are putting their spin on it. But I think that the biggest thing that I'm looking for is that sort of growth mindset, that they're actually open. They will try something new, even if they don't know what it is. You can teach people how to build new systems, deploy new cloud infrastructure, write new code, but it's more expensive to teach people to think differently. And, for me personally, when I'm looking for people, it's around just the mindset and the willingness to, just try new things. I remember when, when we were hiring at Lightwire, one of the people that we actually had sort of interview, I asked him, what sort of projects have you got that you've done on the side? And he said, oh, well, I really like video games. So I wrote this little thing that would look at the top Twitch videos and then sort of repost those on my, on his own channel. And I was just like, okay, for me, that's thinking differently. That's absolutely nothing to do with what we're employing you for, but you've just got that experimentation mindset, love video games, tick that box. So, it's just that whole thinking differently and, just sort of putting yourself out there.
And so from thinking about the biggest blocker to making it work, to making Agile work, is it just simply that entrenched mindset, this is how I've always done it? Is there anything else that sort of rates as high as that for a blocker?
Yeah, so I guess if we sort of flip it around the other way, I think the biggest successes I've seen is when there has been a lot of support from leadership, particularly the exec teams, where they're fully aligned. They understand exactly why we're doing this. Like, what is the previous state of the way of working, the way of the business, and what do we think we're solving moving forward? I think once you've got that and vertically that sort of aligned within the business, I think that's one thing that removes that blocker. The other one is again, as you say, around that sort of mindset. If you've got people that are just continually doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different outcome, I'm not sure that those are the people that are helping you accelerate. So, everyone's got their different challenges. Learning new ways of working can be quite difficult for some people. So you've just got to go in with a bit of empathy, and you've got to, just sort of quite often work with people one-on-one. A lot of my time with the recent reorganization that we did at Voyager was just one-on-one meetings, just sort of talking with people, just explaining to them why the way that we were working before wasn't accelerating what we're doing and what we're hoping to do now, and that it isn't an instant change, that we need to sort of take the learnings, feedback in, and just sort of continually open. But the other one that I think really inhibits is psychological safety. If you don't have the ability to put your hand up and say, I don't know the answer to this, I've never done this before, if you think that people ridicule you for that, you've probably not got the supportive culture that's going to, again, accelerate what you're doing. So I think there's a whole lot of stuff that can either, you know, speed it up or slow it down. But like I said at the very beginning, I don't think any of the clients that I've worked with or any of the stories that I've seen have really failed at Agile. I think they've just missed the opportunity to actually, you know, sort of kick it off.
So are we sort of at peak Agile? Like, is this the crest of the wave, or was that a while ago? Like, are people, is it still kind of the buzzword from where you sit? Because it was for a while, right? Like, I can't remember which year it was, but Spark came out with it and made a lot of press. Maybe it's just because of my telco focus, but for me, I was like, wow, they're really, really pushing this as a fundamental, like, transformation of their organization. Since then, have you seen it only increase, or is there a size of business where it's very much in vogue, but below that it's sort of more BAU?
Well, I think you've just got to look at Trade Me, Seek, LinkedIn. You know, it's flooded with agile coaching jobs, scrum masters, you know, people to come in and help transform the business. I don't think it's at the peak. I think people are just like, people are starting to reflect on why they're not able to compete at the same level as maybe somebody that's smaller and a bit more scrappy. So I think they're starting to look into that. They're looking at how can Netflix scale up so quickly? How can Amazon, you know, be a, you know, multi-billion dollar company? And, you know, it's around taking some gambles on some things, you know, but that experimentation mindset and sort of moving forward. But I don't think we're sort of at the peak. You know, I think there's just going to be iteration, but there's always going to be that sort of the laggards, you know, the lagging behind that, you know, in 10 years, they'll be starting to adopt Agile, you know, and they're massively behind the curve.
Do you think sometimes the smaller organizations, the smaller MSPs that maybe we work with, without really knowing it, without explicitly stating it, are Agile organizations just, you know, because they are, you know, they've got more people doing more things, wearing more hats, closer working relationships with each other, probably more of them having direct customer comms just based on the size. So it's more about companies at that scale understanding that as they win through their you know, deep customer comms, through their genuine focus on the customer experience, that as they grow, they have to start to understand that that is their secret sauce, that that is what makes them successful, and then start to really integrate that into their core philosophy as a business.
Yeah, I'd agree totally. You know, sort of I was reflecting on sort of Agile and Scrum over the last 10 years for me, and I realized that, you know, when we did some work, I think when I met you, it was probably like nearly 10 years ago, and when we were working then, it was very much an iterative process. We had a whole lot of stuff that we just didn't know, but we had to get done. So we just sort of rolled up our sleeves and sort of moved forward. So I think pockets of that business were, you know, sort of working with an agile mindset, but there was other parts of the business that were sort of more traditional. This is the way that we've always done it. So going back to, you know, the question about the MSPs, I would definitely say that some of the smaller ones, particularly ones that have probably been sort of stood up in the last 5 or 10 years, they've probably been more immersed in a sort of agile way of thinking and doing, because that's just sort of more the norm than it was, you know, sort of 10 years prior.
Yeah, that totally makes sense. Maybe because just finish off, because this actually might take a little while, but I kind of wanted to step through those 12 principles that you mentioned at the outset. So I sort of had, I guess, some points, I guess, I noticed against each. So the first one is, as I quickly scroll to it, our highest priority is to satisfy the customer through early and continuous delivery of valuable software. So that there, I mean, it just makes sense. The notion I had was that it focuses on sustainable shareholder return based on a customer focus and, you know, good profits, you know, ones that don't have a short-term focus. They're focused, you're not even focused on profits. You're focused on customer experience, and profits are derived from that over the long term.
That just makes sense, right?
No, totally. So the second one is welcome changing requirements even late in development. So my question for you around that was, scope creep was always a thing in projects. How do you change mindsets from, well, that wasn't what was agreed, to, okay, cool, so we need to achieve something slightly different. Let's sit down and talk about that. How do you frame that in a productive way?
Well, let's sort of move it backwards a little bit. If we're working in sprints that are only 2 weeks, what have we lost? We've lost potentially up to 10 business days worth of value. But quite often, you're not chucking that work out. You're changing it some way. Maybe you're pausing it because there's some higher priority within the business. But again, it's, you know, quite often there'll be a public holiday in there. So, you know, what's that? 9 days. So, you know, it's really not a long period of time when you think about it with that sort of mindset.
Yeah, that's a really good point too. So 12 principles behind the Agile Manifesto. Number three was, to your point, delivering working software frequently. So from a couple of weeks to a couple of months with a preference to the shorter timescale. So that ties into what you just said, in that if you're regularly presenting a finished sprint, if you're saying we achieved XYZ, it's a chance to review, to mark it as done, at which point you can say, oh, wait, that didn't actually tick the box we thought it was going to tick. And to your point, you've only lost 10 days, which I guess is a reason for your shorter sprints, where you said 2 weeks has always worked pretty well by and large.
So I'll just go back a little bit with that one as well, is that the question for you is, if we're building something and we haven't released it and our customers aren't using it, is there any value in that? So that's the key driver between delivering frequently as often as we can. Quite often the teams that I'm working with are quite small, so we try and release smaller features more often. Less things can go wrong if it's smaller, rather than bundling up a whole quarter's worth of work and next thing you know that they've got to spend like a whole week doing the deployment.
Good point. The fourth one here was business people and developers must work together throughout the project, which leads to tribes.
Yep,
basically
makes total sense.
Yep.
Yeah.
Number five, build projects around motivated individuals. Give them the environment and support they need and trust them to get the job done.
If you've got demotivated individuals on your team, you're probably not maximizing.
Yeah, that's right. I guess my question is, how does reporting around commit numbers and burn down charts feed into this? Just in terms of the environment that you're creating, how much does reporting feed into that? And I guess, are all people motivated by detailed reporting on how much they've done over a period?
Yeah, I guess the question is, what value does that add? If they're continually delivering exactly what we agree on, then that's what we agree on. And I would say that that's probably a stronger metric to report on.
Mm. Yep. Number six.
More proficient, they can do more with less and so forth. So, quite often it's never apples for apples when you're comparing people's productivity. Somebody might be more, on the right side as a senior. Somebody might be, slightly left on the left-hand side as far as a sort of junior. So therefore you can't sort of compare their capabilities one for one.
Mm. I want to get back onto that, a touch on point eight, but just to be chronological about this and to go down the list, number six in the Agile Manifesto is the most efficient and effective method of conveying information to and within a development team is face-to-face conversation. So that must be pretty negotiable, particularly given a time where everyone's working remotely, COVID's ruined all the face-to-face comms. I assume that one may have made a lot of sense back in, I'm going to say, 2001, was it?
Yeah.
And probably less so now.
The way that I've tried to explain it to people is, I think face-to-face over video and video over voice and voice over chat and chat over email, so that you've actually got the most effective communication mechanism wherever you can. I personally don't think that there's anything wrong with video calls versus face-to-face. Quite often you can actually pick up just some of the subtleties, as you're sort of leading into meetings that you don't get on the video call. So there's, just some of those softer sort of cues that you might not pick up on, which is where that face-to-face, sort of adds that value. I mean, you'll know that from the, the sales world as well, right?
Yeah, no, I totally agree with that sort of order in terms of preference. We're just lucky to have the tools that we have now, which definitely weren't quite as well evolved in 2001 when this was written. Number seven is working software is the primary measure of progress. To which I say, does that mean that the customer, internal or external facing, or can it mean a demo that proves that two systems are now successfully integrating is an indication that progress is being made? Like, exactly what's the measure there?
I think, come back to that definition of done. What does done mean? So if done in this instance for this piece of work means that it's actually in an environment where your clients can test it, they can get some feedback, or whether it's actually, you know, out in production. But you're not really maximizing on the value unless your real customers are actually physically using this stuff day to day.
Okay. Number eight, this is what I want to come back to. Agile processes promote sustainable development. The sponsors, developers, and users should be able to maintain a constant pace indefinitely. So when we talk about constant pace, but the projects will vary, how do we size that pace? I guess you've with us, you worked on sort of sizing sort of elements within a project, you know, small, medium, large t-shirt sizing, that kind of thing. But is it that you say, I want a number of commits? Is it that you say, I want a number of specifically sized tasks with a total of, you know, let's say 15 points or whatever it is? How do you assess that pace?
Well, first off, I think we definitely don't want to lead into burnout territory. So that's why that sustainable pace is so important. I think if you're doing repeatable work where you're doing the same thing for the next 2 weeks that you've done before, you've got some sort of way to compare apples for apples. If you're doing project A and project B and they're quite radically different, you probably need to use previous experience to be able to figure out, you know, what's involved. But I try and get people to move away from estimating and the number of hours that they think this is. Start thinking about how complex is this, how much effort's involved in doing this work, how much coordination do we have between different parts of the business. It starts thinking deeper about the piece of work that you've got. And quite often, you know, people will go, right, I've completed all of my work. And then again, back to your question is, have all the videos been done? Have they been uploaded to the website so that people actually know how to use this? So it's everything's sort of connected together. And, you know, again, if we remove those hours and we think about the effort and the complexity of that work, that gives you a different way to sort of measure that. And it's why in sort of Scrum, they try and move you away from estimating in hours, because how many times has somebody given you an estimate and it's not right?
Every time.
You know, we're terrible at estimates, but abstracting those estimates away somehow becomes easier over time.
Yeah, you're right. That's always kind of blown out. And when you try and measure things by time, I did like the t-shirt sizing model that you came up with us though, but again, it can be hard to compare task A to task B across two very different projects and size them accurately. We've probably, thinking about our current processes, fallen a little bit back into sizing things by the number of time it's going to take people over how many sprints, which is basically working in hours again. So it's dressing the same thing up, you know, slightly differently.
But I mean, if that works for you guys and you've got a high level of confidence in whatever measurement scheme that you've got, if it works, it works. If it doesn't, maybe it's, you know, time to run a little experiment for the next sprint. You know, we'll just try a different way to sort of estimate. Maybe it's around that complexity and effort and so forth. With Voyager, I proposed the t-shirt sizing, small, medium, large. They ran it for one sprint and then said that they wanted to use Fibonacci because it was, they found that the t-shirt sizing was too restrictive. So
what's Fibonacci?
Who knows?
What is that? What's Fibonacci, or did I even say
so
that?
So it's a sort of an increasing scale where the previous numbers are multiplied together. So, you know, in the instance, we try and say that, you know, is this thing a three? Well, it's actually more than a three. Okay, well, that's actually a five then, rather than being a three. So you're sort of abstracting away from the way that you actually sort of size stuff out. Again, it's totally arbitrary. You know, it has absolutely zero bearing on the amount of time it's going to take. We quite often do planning poker as well. So everyone in the team just holds up a card that's got a number on it that they estimate. And then we sort of talk around the team as to, you know, why did you say it was a five? Oh, because I've done this before and it's caught me out. We've got no documentation. You know, the system's never been touched in the last 2 years. So, you know, and again, you know, when somebody holds up a one, you know, what leads you to think that you know, it's a one? Oh, well, I do this every day. You know, I can do it in my sleep kind of thing. You know, so it gets people talking.
All right. Well, at the risk of pushing on with a punishing list, I've got three left in this. I like four. So number nine, the manifesto was continuous attention to technical excellence and good design enhances agility. So my question there really is just, how's that driven and who QA's design? Like, again, does it change every single time? Is it just about find something that works to ensure that happens?
Yeah. So I mentioned earlier that one of the critiques that I quite often hear is that people don't want to use Agile because they think we sort of cut corners. And I think in all of the mature teams that I've worked with, it's the total opposite. Once they actually get up to speed, they're thinking deeper about the work that they've got. In this instance here, quite often, we'll have stories that will be pending architecture review. So here's what we think we want to build, but we need somebody that's got a high level of oversight that understands the infrastructure, the security, the privacy, various implications to make sure that we're doing the right thing, and that, that we can sort of deliver on that. So I think that's, that plays to that part. And a lot of the cross-functional teams that I'm seeing is that we're ensuring that there's a software tester. And I'm sort of moving away from the term software tester to sort of a QA engineer, that they're actually thinking about the quality of everything that we deliver, not just defects in the code that we're writing. That if we're, deploying a new WAN, for example, there's some components that we want to run speed tests. We want to make sure that, VLANs transport across and various bits and pieces. So these QA engineers are actually sort of helping us think deeper about what we're doing and ensuring that we're not cutting any corners, that, that we're actually going through the proper process. And again, it's not adding too much overhead, but it's ensuring that we're not, cutting corners to speed things up.
Yeah, I guess, and if you're the QA engineer, the best person wouldn't just be saying, are we meeting the definition of done, but are there low-hanging opportunities, I guess, to slightly enhance that version through some easy wins, kind of looking at it from that user experience, again, coming back to the whole thing, which is customer focus. What can we do to make their lives better?
And what we're seeing in the sort of the testing in the QA space is this thing called move left, where those people aren't tasked with building the test plans after everything's been done. They're actually doing all of that upfront so that they can actually say, while we're working on this, we need to be mindful of these components and how they interoperate, and ensuring that we're sort of building stuff out. And some of the best QA engineers that I've worked with are really working with a coaching hat on, so that they're actually coaching everyone in the team to actually think with that quality mindset that, it's no overhead. It's actually the sort of the gold standard that we bring and that we demand as a team.
I love that. Also, that whole concurrent approach, right? Like, it's not a consecutive set of work where I've done my bit, now your turn. It's very much, no, we're working together, start to finish. It's all overlapping.
Fully collaborative.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And that's what's baked into the Agile Manifesto is that high level of collaboration. It doesn't spell out that person A has to collaborate with person B. It's just that whole mindset that everything that we do, and again, this is probably why we're advocating for face-to-face, is that these people can just get around a table, they can sort of brainstorm and ensure that we're doing the right thing.
There's no doubt that face-to-face engenders those passive conversations where just things naturally kind of come up almost completely unrelated conversations often. So that, I totally get that value. Hey, number 10, I didn't get simplicity. The art of maximizing the amount of work not done is essential. Please tell me what that means.
So I think Steve Jobs had a saying, and I could be wrong, sometimes it's more important to say no than to say yes. It's very easy to add features. It's very difficult to actually remove them once they're in there. Adding things adds complexity to everything that we do. So just being really mindful about what we're committing to and making sure that it's actually sort of connected to some sort of value.
Okay. That makes sense. That makes me feel better.
Just think about some of the features that we've built in, say, Illume, for example. Are all of those used by customers? Because obviously we've got this operational cost of maintaining that moving forward. And if no one's using it, do we deprecate it? Do we, what do we do? And this is why a whole lot of telcos end up with these things that they really should grandfather, but they don't. And they've got, mixed pricing tiers that are no longer used and all sorts of, it's just messy, messy business. And it's got a hidden cost, I think, that people don't see.
Definitely. And for me, a big part there is you've got to understand the user experience, the user behavior. If you don't have data that tells you, okay, how often is this feature being used, by which type of customer, are they, the customers that we're targeting or not? Have we actually developed the rest of our ecosystem around that type of customer? Are the observed behaviors what we expected? And being absolutely frank, we haven't nailed that. We haven't nailed the understanding of the user behavior post-launch, and that's what we're working on now.
If you think back to the Momi, when we built that startup, we were in the mindset that we needed to build an app on people's phones, and then we actually found out that people actually use this thing one time to set up their recurring lawn mows, and then they don't really care and they don't want the expense of having to go to the App Store and find it and download it. They literally want a link to click on to fill in a form to go through this process. So again, that's probably a really good example of that simplicity and saying no to particular things.
Definitely. The other thing there for me, and makes me feel better about that particular one, while I didn't understand it up front, we are practicing that, particularly with the scoping of work with key stakeholders and understanding when the dev team is actually ready to kick off for something. We sit down and say, is this actually what you're hoping to achieve? And we're like, well, no, we really don't need that, but we do need this. And, you know, what happens if? And we just talk through it. And often we find that so much potential work is removed just from talking through that we go, oh, this actually isn't as big a job as we thought it was going to be. So yeah, we can get this done quicker. Or, you know, maybe we'll stage that. Stage one is this, because that takes, you know, 2 weeks and it's going to be great. Stage two, much more complex. How important is it? Let's see what buy-in we get for stage one release, whether that really is as important to customers as we thought it was going to be. So yes, actually,
it's a discipline. I think that saying no to stuff, and it's that whole sort of minimalism mindset that just by adding doesn't necessarily give you what you need. So keep doing that.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, number 11, the best architectures, requirements, and designs emerge from self-organizing teams. I have one note here, and that is, how so?
So I think it's coupled with that sort of QA mindset again, that we're not cutting corners. We're making sure that we're bringing in those right stakeholders to sort of build the right things. And again, really sort of specifying any of those user stories that we're building the right thing. We're using the right tools, the right technology, the right platforms and so forth. But yeah, that's the only answer I've got for that, if that helps.
Mate, that does. It's better than I could do. All right, let's finish off on number 12. At regular intervals, the team reflects on how to become more effective, then tunes and adjusts its behaviors accordingly, which really comes back to retrospectives, as far as I can tell. Just don't, maybe and the definition of done. It's not done till you've done a retro. If you haven't actually stopped to think about, was it what it could have been? Was it more than it could have, than we thought it would be? And which parts drove it either way? That kind of seems to be...
It's that whole continual improvement mindset. It's just keep doing that. I think, and you don't necessarily need to wait for that 2 week or that regular interval to actually reflect on stuff. If you're seeing something, midway through the sprint, that's just going to, we can't get it done because of the way that we're working or some arbitrary constraint, fix it then, iterate on that, learn and move forward.
Okay.
It's just that continual improvement mindset.
Another thing that we're doing relatively well, and a lot of the businesses I work with are as well, probably again, though, often without realizing that that's a key part of the Agile framework. I keep saying framework. I'm not sure whether that's right. Is it a framework? It's just a set of guiding principles. I think that's probably one of the key takeaways. And then you can build your own frameworks and methodologies around that way of thinking.
Yep.
Cool.
Absolutely.
All right, look at me wrapping that up nicely. All right, Tim, before I let you go, anything you want to plug? I know you've got Unfuddle, your own consultancy business. Anything you want to plug while you got the chance?
Yeah, well, I guess, if there's anybody out there that's got a sort of an engineering team, that they feel that isn't sort of performing at the level that they want, or there's some challenges that you just can't see how to sort of move forward on, reach out, provide my contact details, and we'll see if there's an opportunity to work together.
They can find you on LinkedIn. Unfuddle has its own page, but also Tim Phillips 1L.
Yeah, that's right.
That's right. Look at me, nailed it. Cool. That's where to find them. All right, Tim, thanks heaps for your time today. I've certainly learned a lot. Hopefully a lot of our partners out there do as well about Agile, and hopefully if required, they reach out to you to talk more.
Awesome. Thank you.
Thanks, man.